you have to have a compartment in your mind to where that you can separate all of these. And well, now we're talking about this, but now we're talking about that. Well, we were talking about sin, but now we're talking about mercy. And now we're talking about judgment. Yes, judgment, that's true, but now we're talking about this. And hasn't it been a marvelous thing to find that the gospel is a seamless garment woven throughout? That it's not you have to discontinue talking about this to talk about that. But it is indeed one whole picture of one mighty and powerful understanding of how God decided that he did not want to live in heaven anymore. That's pretty audacious, isn't it? You know, I wasn't the one that said that when the prophets prophesied about Emmanuel and that his name would be Emmanuel, God with us. I didn't prophesy that. I wasn't the one who looked at the human race and said, I will dwell in earthen vessels. That's where my choice is. You know, if you're looking for a home, I try to look for the best one. You know, where would I exist best? Where would, you know, they've got feng shui, they've got all kinds of things as to how your house is decorated, and the view, you know, the view is very important, right? And location, 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 right? So you've got all these things, and I don't think that God left these things out of his decision to locate himself in you. I think he knew not just you would benefit,
that's cool,
but that he would benefit. This is the thing that many people don't like about the gospel revolution, is that we say that God gained a lot through the cross also. When you look and you find, I've always often asked people, I said, if you found somebody that was angry and wrathful and jealous by their own admission, and then something happened to where that they were no longer angry and wrathful and jealous, most people would say they got saved, right? Well, whatever you might want to call it, we know that all anger and wrath and jealousy all ceased 2,000 years ago through the power of the cross. And now there is this, you know, how many ways did the prophets try to tell us it would happen? Tried to tell us through the marriage, these two shall become one. And so, and once then, and what God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. How many ways was it prophesied that a time would come in human history to where that the God out there would no longer be out there? If you take all of the struggle of the human race of the last 2,000 years, it has been the struggle of adjusting to this new reality. You want to know why people are still taking knives and cutting people's heads off and doing all these things? I'm telling you, there's much of the world's problems. Of course, we know most of that's caused by religion itself. When we learn that God did something so powerful that he literally, with, and there's just no other way to say it other than literally, and in the most quantitative way, has made himself one with the human race. Equally and in all, that man's understanding of that is where we begin to interface with life in a different way. If you believe there's an angry God, let me tell you something. Tools of the trade. Boy, there's never been a more important statement ever made than having tools for the trade. Nothing like the tool to do, the right tool for the right job. Basically, what the human race has done without for 2,000 years, we've got the tool and the tools, but we've just never figured out how to use them to accomplish the work that needs to be done. It was so weird as I started going through this. I talked to Barris, got counseling on it. I told him, I said, Barris, I'm impressed with screwdrivers. Michael, why are you impressed with screwdrivers? Well, it's just so amazing. I'm a human, and there's a screw in the wall, and I could gnaw my teeth out trying to get that screw out of there. I could whittle my fingers down to the bone trying to get that screw out of the wall. But if I just simply picked up a screwdriver, a Phillips head screwdriver with a Phillips screw, and a handle that fits a person's hand, and put the Phillips head on the end of it, there's an interface. There's something between me and the job that needs to be done, that suddenly an impossible job is now easy. It's easy. Don't you just envy people with power tools? I believe the human race is just now waking up to the power tools that have been at our disposal for 2,000 years. Our last 2,000 years has shown us, and over the years, my goodness, look what all we have done as man begins to interface with life in a whole different way. There's not a one of you in here that does not have your own phone that you carry around with you, that you are potentially in contact with every human being, any human being on the face of this earth at any given moment. Things are changing so fast, folks. Now you say, but you're talking about technology. But folks, you've got to understand that all of this technology is a reflection of God in us. That's what it is a true reflection of. All of these things that man can do if he can learn what the interface with life is. You see, what I see when I see a jihadist taking a knife and taking and slitting somebody's throat, and not to trivialize this in any way, I see someone literally who doesn't know how to use the screwdriver yet. There are things they want to accomplish. There are things that we can debate with their perceptions and why they do what they do. But the fact of it is, folks, that as the human race learns how to interface with this planet from a point of being, this is God in the earth. But the temptation to separate those evildoers from the rest of us and to lose the revelation of the fact that God indwells all is the biggest challenge that we have right now. We have people in the Gospel Revolution that, you know, as we've shared over the years, you guys have watched this. We've seen people, it's like opening prison doors. And as they come running out, you never know what direction they're going. And haven't they gone every direction possible? Every direction possible, even into other religions even. Excuse me. But you see, as we, the things that we understand more and more now in this great thing that happened to this planet 2,000 years ago, I think we are just beginning to have gotten past just laying the foundation to where that we can understand how this truly affects life. Now, every person here can give me stories of how it's affected your life. But you know, there's one thing to knowing that first time you learn to pick up a screwdriver and using it, and to becoming proficient at using it to accomplish a big job. Mentally and emotionally, the gospel integrates us with life. It integrates us with society. The gospel integrates us with ourselves. The biggest enemy you've ever had on this planet has not been the person sitting next to you. The biggest enemy you've ever had is not your neighbor. The biggest enemy you've ever had is you. Isn't it nice to at least have that battle over with? That's a powerful thing. This week I'm going to be speaking to you about five things that Paul said changed at the cross. They're very powerful things that changed. We had talked about them on the PowerCast, and I told Barris, I said, I've got to get this recorded. So I think that during this time, we will be able to get that done. And it is true. Paul gave us five different things that changed. In fact, there's many more than five things that changed at the cross. But as you see, once you begin to see that one of them could not have changed unless they all changed simultaneously. It was the proverbial clock striking at midnight and all the bells and everything going off at one time. Everything happened at in a split second, in a moment, if you will. In the twinkling of an eye, everything changed. Now, we've had 2,000 years to try to adjust to these changes. We've tried to explain these changes. We have interfered with the changes that took place by sharing things that are not true. But now we begin to understand some of the most powerful things that we've ever learned, and we're still just learning the gospel. Nothing more, nothing less than Jesus Christ and righteousness. That's what it's all about, right? Where do you get your righteousness from? It's amazing. One of the things that Paul said changed. He said that this corruptible must have put on incorruption. This mortal must put on immortality. Isn't it amazing? All the churches we went to said when we got saved that we became immortal, right? Wonder why they didn't tell us we became incorruptible too. Why didn't they tell us that there is nothing that could corrupt us? No deed, no action could corrupt us the same way that Adam was corrupted when this all started. Why leave the same problem potentially able to take place again by sending such drastic measures to terminate the problem and then leave the very same problem open to possibly happening again? That changed at the cross. And you are, and this planet, you as every and every individual on this planet remains in God's eyes completely incorruptible. I know I've said that many hundreds of times, but I cannot allow those words to come out of my mouth without it having an impact on me. Incorruptible. I tried to get my brain around immortal. That's an even bigger step for me. But to come to grips with the fact that there is nothing that can separate us from the love of God. Not a thing. Nothing. Instead of learning what to do about all the things that can separate us from God, to learn that nothing can separate us from God is far more powerful than learning the pseudo ways to take care of it when there's a problem. Because there now is no more problem. Don Bartlett has become a dear friend of mine. His wife, Laura, to find a really good woman, this Australian man had to wait until a good Tennessee girl visited Australia. You guys know him from Tennessee, right? So on a missionary trip there, I don't know, maybe she's trying to get him saved or something. I know she's on a mission trip. I don't know if it's worked or not, but Don, I've learned so much from this man, and not only have I learned from him, but also it's wonderful to have people in your life that you can say the outlandish things that you're thinking about without them responding like, "What's wrong with you?" Yeah. And Don holds his composure until he figures out what's wrong with me, and then he tells me what's wrong with me. He doesn't ask me what's wrong with it. But this has been a wonderful friendship, and he's my confidant. I turn to him for so many things. And Laura, his wife, is sometimes she likes me pretty good too. Yeah.
And I'm going to look into that.
Tim. So, if you will, I'm going to ask you guys, you've been so gracious to me over all of these years to welcome me in that wonderful Calgary way. I'm going to ask you to greet my friend, Barris Bartlett, with the Gospel Revolution. Thank you.
Hey, buddy. Want to give me that recorder?
Yes.
Well, let's start right there, shall we?
Yes. Ask him a question and he's gone.
My name is Donald Allen Beresford Bartlett, and my parents were cruel in other ways too. Let me just thank you first for having me here. Victor Brannan and Debbie down there who take care of the Grace conferences up here in Canada. Thank you so much for everything you do for us, and thank you for inviting me up here. And thank you, family, for having me. We'll see if this ever happens again. We'll soon find out. Now, this American guy came down to Australia, and I need to tell you this because it kind of paints a bit of the background for tonight. And we went camping, and we had a bit of liquid refreshment, if you know what I mean. And sometime in the middle of the night, I woke up and I looked up at the stars, and I said to him, this American guy, I said, hey, look up, what do you see? He says, I see stars and stars and stars and stars. And I said, what's that tell you? And he said, well, astronomically speaking, it tells me there's billions of universes out there and potential for billions more. Astrologically speaking, it tells me that Saturn is in Leo. Orologically speaking, it tells me it's about 3:30 in the morning. Meteorologically speaking, it tells me that it's going to be a pretty nice day tomorrow. And theologically speaking, it tells me that I'm just a small, minuscule part of God's whole creation. Why? What do you see? What's that tell you? And I said, you idiot. It tells me that someone stole the tent. My purpose for being here is to bring you to a place where you'll find value in doing your own research on the two fundamentals of redemptionism: the veracity of the scriptures and the resurrection of Jesus the Christ. I implore you, don't leave these sessions just because you've heard somebody talking about these subjects and think you've done your own background research. Don't make that mistake, because you haven't. And my deep plea for people is, do your own research. We're going to look into this a little bit further, but don't leave here thinking that you've already done that. I'm going to share with you why I believe the scriptures, that which Jesus called the law, the Psalms, and the prophets, are a fixed landmark upon which we can rely. And I'll be comparing them with what we commonly call the New Testament. We'll be doing that tonight. I'll also be addressing why redemptionism asserts that Jesus the Christ was the high point of human history, the focal point of God's eternal plan regarding humanity, and the prototype of what Paul calls the new creation. After that, I'll be sharing why I thoroughly believe in the reality of the resurrection. Most of us lack either the time or the inclination to do our own research. As Mark Twain said, in religion and politics, people's beliefs and convictions are in almost every case gotten secondhand and without examination from authorities who themselves have not examined those questions at issue, but have taken them at secondhand from other non-examiners whose opinions about them weren't worth a brass farthing. I agree. What about you? I have people tell me that they've studied these topics only to discover with a simple handful of questions that they're either fooling themselves or they're liars. Most academic experts will happily tell you that they won't offer an opinion on anything that is outside their area of expertise. And yet, let's face it, there are two areas that everybody's an expert on: politics and religion. In fact, we're born experts in these areas. There are three kinds of people who approach this subject, or these subjects. One is historical revisionists. These people are rewriting history, in this case, to present a dumbed-down Jesus for a dumbed-down society. those with an agenda to create a Jesus that can be appreciated as a good and wise teacher. I want you to remember those words, a good and wise teacher. This is what we have people today wanting to reduce Jesus down to, a good and wise teacher. We're going to see tonight why that is an utter impossibility. And when it comes to trying to present that to me in the name of intelligence, it's ludicrous. They give me this Jesus, too weak to tear the skin off a rice pudding. No miracles, no virgin birth, no resurrection, nothing. He's the same as any other good and wise teacher. Historical revisionists come at things with an a priori approach. A priori simply means you're coming at it with your agenda already set. And if whatever they discover doesn't fit in to what they already believe is true, out it goes, out the window. They sound great, but when it comes down to cold facts and logic, they offer little to impress a thinking mind. They say, miracles are impossible, so they can't be true. So anyone who says that they are true must be either ignorant or a liar, because miracles don't happen, because miracles are impossible, so they can't be true. So anyone who says they are true is either ignorant or a liar, because miracles can't happen, because miracles are impossible. Blah, blah, blah. This is called circular reasoning. They've already come at their conclusion, and that is their starting point. This is called circular logic, and it describes an a priori approach. Such people are attempting to create a Christ that'll sell on their conditions to their society for their reasons, whatever they might be. The second group of people are journalists, what I call journalists. Journalists print whatever they're told to print, whatever they're paid to print. They're the tame dogs of their paymasters. This includes every preacher whose wallet is dependent on being heard to say the right things. Anyone here know anyone like that? The third group of people is we the sheeple. Opinionated but ignorant of any real facts. Sheeple aren't paid to believe anything, but they believe it anyway. They're sheeple. They're just lazy enough to never research for themselves and too vain to admit it. They believe what suits themselves to believe based on what the teacher that appeals to them the most told them to believe. Then because they've listened to somebody else's opinion, not research, just opinions mostly, they convince themselves that they have actually done the research groundwork themselves and claim as much. Do you know anyone like that? That describes me. Not anymore. I'm born again now. There are three reasons why some people refuse to look at these claims. One, they're afraid they can't be defended, and so they may lose their faith. Now, a lot of people in religion fall into this category. Second reason, they say, why waste my time on what is a high improbability? And the third reason is, if it's true, I might have to change my lifestyle. I'm not sure I'm up to that right now at this point in my life. I've still got girls to meet. Whatever. The majority of modern scholars of Christian history agree on two fundamental points. Now, I'm not talking about Christian scholars. I'm talking about Christian history scholars. I'm talking about scholars of the Bible, people like John Spong, people like Bart Ehrman, who's an agnostic but started off as a fundamental evangelical. I'm talking about people who've gone through the whole process. The majority, and they're agnostics and atheists. The majority of modern scholars of Christian history agree on two fundamental points. And one is the belief in the resurrection was the chief reason for the spread and growth of Christianity. Without the resurrection, how could it possibly have happened? And early evidences for a real or imagined resurrection appear from very close to or immediately following the date of Jesus' death. Like Paul said, over 500 are still alive. They're walking around amongst us. We can ask them their story. We're going to talk a moment about historic certainty and psychological certainty. Now, it is a fact that there is no such thing as historic certainty. I cannot convince you that you had a great-great-great-grandfather if you never saw him. I can't convince you of that. You can't convince me you had one. I can't see him. Neither can you. Historic certainty means every conceivable piece of evidence is here for us to examine here and now. That which you can conceive as possible evidence must be there to have historic certainty. The moment an event is in the past, you've lost the eyewitness ability to see it. Cameras help, but there's an element gone, so all historic certainty, by definition, is relative. All you can hope for is psychological certainty. All you can hope for is psychological certainty where exposure to the relevant facts of history that are available produces a reaction psychologically. And that reaction is impossible not to have. Any smart attorney knows that. In any courtroom, there's an attorney who says things they know the judge is going to instruct the jury to ignore. But some bells you can't unring, can you? And that attorney knows exactly what he's doing. Oh, he plays a game and he says, oh, yes, sorry, judge, but the jury have heard whatever it was he said. And what they heard, they heard. And it's inevitably going to have some influence on the case's outcome, no matter how small. You see and hear and feel, and whatever response that has in you, you still interpret that as evidence of something. There is historical truth and there is psychological truth. Historical truth is truth that can be re-examined time and again, always yielding the same logical results. Psychological truth is truth made evident to one on the basis of one's personal experience. All historical truth is relative. Psychological truth is not so relative. You can't psychologically prove to me that you took a shower this morning. You can't do it. I wasn't there. And I can't prove to you that I took one this morning either, because you weren't there. Psychological certainty, historical certainty. Those 500 people that Paul said were still alive at the time he wrote those words and who saw Jesus in the flesh after the resurrection had both historical truth and psychological truth. They'd seen it with their own eyes, and what they had seen with their own eyes was enough to convince them. Psychological truth in our system of law is often called forensic psychology. A good example of forensic psychology is circumstantial evidence. And if you don't believe that this is much more important than historical certainty, remember this, that eyewitness accounts are often held as being the weakest of all evidence. And there's plenty of people who've been sent to the death chamber on nothing but circumstantial evidence. In other words, the evidence that was presented, there was nothing definite. No, I didn't see him there. I can't identify him. But there was enough little things put together that when you looked at them as a whole, there was nowhere else to go but he must be guilty. Now, we celebrate this in our justice system, what we hold to be the highest system of, well, mores in the land, allegedly. Careful, I saw that. I heard that giggle. Forensic psychology is that which causes people to come to a condition based on the weight, accuracy, and the convincing quality of the evidence placed before them. That Jesus moved onto the stage of history is our claim. As one of the fundamental claims of redemptionism. That he vindicated himself with a fact, the resurrection, that can be analysed with the same certainty that we apply to anyone else like Caesar Augustus or Alexander the Great or Henry VIII or every poor soul who was ever sent to the firing squad on only overwhelming circumstantial evidence. Now, before we go any further, I want to clear up some definitions. We're going to talk about when the canon of Scripture, the alleged canon of Scripture, was formalised and when it was canonised. Canonized simply means that the church accepted that this was the gold standard. This was what should be in the Bible. This was what should not be in the Bible. It's canonized. It's a canon of Scripture. Canon is a Latin word simply meaning a straight line. Then we're going to talk about formalized. When was the Bible canonized? Well, it was canonized twice, once in the Old Testament by Jewish scholars, and then once in the Roman Catholic Church at the Council of Trent, where also at the same time you were told to worship Mary around 1580. That's when it was canonized, 1500 years after the birth of Jesus. It was formalized about 300 years after the birth of Jesus. That's all it ever was. A translation and a paraphrase. A translation is a word for word, English for Greek or English for Hebrew, and a paraphrase is a thought for thought. Rendition. There's a big difference because when you're giving thoughts, you've got to interpret those thoughts. So when you have a paraphrase, it's up to everybody's opinions. Autographs, manuscripts, papyri, codex, codices. What are these? These are simply the names that are applied to those very early scripts that we do have records of, dating back to the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century. Heterodoxy and orthodoxy. What are they? Who knows a saying that only the victors write the history? History is always written by the victors. Orthodoxy with the victors. Orthodoxy simply means this is the accepted way of doing it. Heterodoxy is based from a Greek word meaning the power to choose. So from the very first, Orthodox folks said these people here choose differently than we do. They're heretics. They believe in heresy. And heresy hunters were around from very early on, 2nd century. Actually, 1st century. In the New Testament, we can see them. First thing we need is a framework, and I'm not going to try and prove to you the resurrection if we don't already know that Jesus lived. So we're going to go back a little bit to, was Jesus a real figure? But we're even going to go back further than that. Now, what a framework is something that I base my life on. Every time I get up in the morning, I figure that my feet are going to hit the floor, not the ceiling. Now, if that wasn't true, I'd be living my life a whole lot differently. But that gives me a framework in which to live. So we're also going to have a framework in which to see, was Jesus a real character? Not going to try to prove that he was resurrected unless we already believe he lived. If down the road, someone listens to a tape and they say, Beres Bartlett taught this in Calgary on such and such a date, well, the first thing we've got to accept is that I was here. If we're going to argue over what I said, don't go saying when you're losing the argument, oh, but you weren't there anyway. So, before we examine the resurrection of Jesus, first let's establish just who and what he was. Now, tomorrow morning, I'm going to be doing a lot more on the resurrection, and then again in another session, we'll be finishing it off. So, this is something we're spreading over a couple nights. Let's go even further back to the scriptures, which predicted his birth, his life, and his death. The standard lies of Christianity is something we've got to look at right now, because these standard lies of Christianity have plagued us all at one time or another. Number one is the church has always been united in vision, purpose, and structure. Nothing could be further from the truth. And we find that in the Bible itself. You don't have to look into history. Just read the Bible. Two, there are existing original manuscripts for the Bible, particularly the New Testament. That is the biggest crock of frogs droppings you will ever hear outside a political campaign. Three, there was a very honest approach to deciding what books were to be in the Bible. Oh, really? Then how come Luther didn't want James in there and put Hebrews and Revelations at the back because he didn't think very much of them either? And how come it was a real fight to get James even into the Bible in the first place? Because you know Paul is always talking about that grace stuff. We need someone over here who'll act as a foil and then we can hammer them together and say, see, that's the whole truth. A duck doesn't fly unless it's got both wings. And that's exactly what happened with the book of James when it was put in the Bible. What was it put in the Bible? How was it decided? This is what orthodoxy claims. Number one, apostolic authority. Really? Who wrote Hebrews? Was that an apostle? B, the rule of faith. Now, the rule of faith was a real common one that is taught in seminary and theological circles, and it simply means this: whatever orthodoxy teaches you is true. If it doesn't agree with what orthodoxy teaches you is true, then it should not be in the Bible. The third one is continuous usage and acceptance by the church at large. Well, there's a problem right there. A fella called, the book called The Shepherd of Hermes was used extensively in the first century. Hebrews, not so much. James, not until about 300 AD. So all of these rules that you'll hear given to you, why books were put in the Bible, they all sound good on the outside. So, firstly, what are the scriptures? Jesus says, don't think that I've come to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy but fulfill. What a self-righteous son of a gun, huh? Whoa! I tell you, we'll look at this later. It doesn't matter if he was perfect. He thought he was perfect. Then in John, Jesus says, search the scriptures. Oh, that must be Hebrews and James and Revelation and Paul's writings and Acts, is it? And the Gospels even. No, they weren't written. Search the Scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life. And they are they which testify of me. And then on the road to Emmaus, Jesus meets the disciples and they're bawling about the bad things that had happened in Jerusalem that week. And Jesus, beginning at Moses in Luke 24, verse 27, says, beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the Scriptures the things concerning himself. What are the Scriptures? What we have established very clearly in the Gospel Revolution is the Scriptures is the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. Jesus attested to it. The disciples attested to it. Now, there are two basic evidences for Scripture: internal evidences and external evidences. Anyone want to go home yet?
No.
Okay. External evidence number one, canonization. The Old Testament was codified and canonized over a period of 1,500 years by religious scholars usually trained from birth to be devoted to the maintenance of a culture dedicated to honoring God. The New Testament was formalized under the authority of one man who devoted his life to being a God. I'm talking of Constantine. In the 2,000 years since the birth of Christ, the Bible, as we now see it, was only canonized 500 years ago. How many people knew that? In 1580-odd. That's the first and only time it's ever been canonized. No Protestant has ever canonized the Bible. Oh, they've taken bits out and put bits in and rewritten it different ways, but they've never canonized it. As I said, that was at the same church council that encouraged you to worship Mary. 400 years after the birth of Christ, Constantine made himself the sole arbiter of what would and what would not constitute the accepted books of the New Testament by assembling those church elders who could come to an agreement about what deserved to be included and disposing, by whatever means necessary, all others who disagreed. And for the sole political purpose of unifying his kingdom under the auspices of one religion that had one set of rules clearly laid out in one document. The rituals and beliefs were of secondary importance to the greater political end. Also remember this, that this same pagan pedophile who murdered his own wife and son titled himself Pontifex Maximus. What's every pope's title? Pontifex Maximus. The original meaning in Latin was the great high priest of the pagans, a title which continues to this day. This is the same emperor god who built a huge Christian cathedral. It's called a basilica back then, and it was on the same floor plans as a pagan basilica, and he put in there 13 marble tombs, 12 around a circle and one in the middle. The 12 were for the 12 apostles, and the one in the middle was for guess who? Yeah, Pontifex Maximus, who else? Now, in spite of all the Roman Catholic claims that he was converted to Christianity, he was buried, there is historical evidence, he was buried with all the ritual and worship with which all Roman emperors before him were buried, all the pagan emperors. When the New Testament was formalized, all those who disagreed with Constantine and his church of choice leaders. When I was a kid, I had to do this play, and I only had one line in the whole play, and the only line I had was, "Lo, a herd of horses." And I said, "Lo, a horde of horses." Oh, boy. The way Constantine did it was he killed off the opposite. It's easy to be right and have no opponents when you can kill them, don't you think? External evidence number one was canonization. External evidence number two, transcription. The first thing under transcription that we need to know is this, that there was specialized training in the Old Testament for taking a scroll and copying it to another scroll. Trained from childhood to be specialist scribes. You remember the story of Samuel? His mum said, "God, give me a son, and if you do, I'll put him in the temple." Wonder what he did in the temple. Huh? Ever thought? There was a whole group, a whole tribe, and that's where tithing came from. Tithing came to support the tribe that was running the theocracy. If you wanted a marriage certificate, a death certificate, if you wanted a birth certificate, you go to the temple. And the temple clerks, Levites, would take care of it. If you wanted to get married, the Levites would oversee it. If there was taxation, the Levites would take care of it. So this whole tribe, one of its jobs was to copy scrolls from one to another. Once they had the scrolls, and scrolls weren't around, by the way, probably until between 600 and 1000 BC. They weren't around like in Samuel or in Moses' days, and we're going to have a look at that in a moment. In the New Testament, there were no trained specialists. In the Old Testament, there's trained specialists. In the New Testament, no trained specialists. No one can point to them. The second point is quality control. One jot or tittle, don't you love those words? A jot or a tittle. One jot or tittle out of place, and the scroll was burned. That's a pretty gutsy move in a day when a scroll cost a bunch of money that it did. The scribes would check on each other as well. Now, the second quality control was something called gematria. Like Chinese characters, in written form, Hebrew is a pictographical language. If you want a mouth in Chinese, there's a mouth. In the alphabet, in the Hebrew, in Greek it goes alpha, beta, gamma, delta. In Hebrew it goes aleph, bet, gimel, daleth. Aleph means a bull's head. It's written like a bull's head with a little horn coming out of it. Bet is written like a tent. You can see the tent and the doorway. Gimel is a camel. And that word has come down to us in English. Gimel, camel. Fascinating how much etymology has transferred from Hebrew into English and other languages. Now, gematria is about the numerical weight of each letter. Aleph was 1, bet was 2, gimel was 3, and so on. When all the letters of a scroll were added together, they gave a total number, and if the number wasn't correct, the scroll was burnt. That was a secondary form of quality control. As for quality control in the New Testament, can anyone tell me who the quality control experts were? The third point in quality control is emotional stability. Calm versus anxiety. Old Testament scribes lived in relative calm with all the tools necessary at their disposal. New Testament scribes were sometimes hunted, sometimes persecuted, often doing their work under the cover of darkness. We talked about that at dinner time there, Vic. The comparison is stark. The comparison's very clear. The next thing we look at is the mode of transcription. Transcription was only from one scroll to one scroll, or one source to another source. But what about the first books of Moses? How were they? Who wrote them? How did Moses ever write about his own death? Now, when you hear people bringing that up, what you're hearing is a furphy. You're hearing a red herring. Because verbal histories are arguably as good as and better than written histories. Every native people that I know of has some kind of a flood story. These are verbal histories, not written histories. If you wish to argue that point, I'll gladly do so after you can show me any written history in which you place full faith. Remember what we said? The victors write the history books. Hebrew writing was around from about 1000 BC, but common from 600 BC. Cuneiform writing was available in Abraham's day. So we don't know exactly when scrolls started to be or when written records commenced. In 1948, we had the Dead Sea Scrolls discovered, in which every one was word for word the same as the other and spread over hundreds of years. The only difference being that the Book of Esther was not in some of them. God seemed so casually unconcerned with preserving the accuracy of New Testament writings that today we have in over 5,500 manuscripts, scrolls and codices, no originals. None. We have originals of the Hebrew. I wonder why God didn't give a rip about the New Testament. Remember that before the invention of the printing press, every publication was copied out by hand, and without the quality control mechanisms that the Old Testament scholars used, copying errors were not just possible but impossible to avoid. We have hundreds of original copies of Old Testament manuscripts, all of which agree with each other, written hundreds of years apart. We have thousands of copies of New Testament manuscripts, none of which match, none of which agree. We have thousands of copies. In fact, all those New Testament manuscripts, there are more differences between them than there are words in the New Testament. Why? Well, because of intentional changes. Sometimes people just didn't like the way it was written. because of corrections based on older or better manuscripts, which was a valid reason to change them. Sometimes because of harmonizations from different documents. They'd bring different gospels together and say, oh, well, we'll just make this a harmony of them. Sometimes it was ideologically motivated, or intentional changes again. Sometimes it was unintentional changes. The person doing the copying by candle, it was a tallow light. It was maybe an oil lamp. And sometimes his eye just went to the next line and missed out a whole line. Where the translator, they just got tired, skipped a line. External evidence number one was canonization. Number two was transcription. Number three is acceptance. Let's talk about different canons. How many different canons? Now, you know what? When I'm saying a canon, I'm saying a formalized, accepted group of books that people call their Bible. That's how I'm using that word now. How many are there? Well, you've got Russian Orthodox Christianity. They've got their own canon. You've got the Eastern Orthodox Christianity. They've got another canon. Greek Orthodox Christianity has their own canon. The Assyrian Church has its own canon. The Armenian Christian Church has its own canon. And remember, there's more. Don't stop there. Remember, the Protestantism is the bastard child of Roman Catholicism. We took what they gave us and changed little to nothing. There are other alleged Protestant churches that either predate or evolved separate to the Protestant Reformation. Remember that. The Church of England, for one, that was never a Protestant church. It is now. We call it a Protestant church, but it never came out of the Protestant Reformation, along with Luther and his group. And all those groups like the Amish, Mennonites, German Brethren, Hutterites that come under the general umbrella of Anabaptists, they were around a couple hundred years before the Protestants ever got off their blessed assurance and did whatever they did. They were never Protestants in the historical sense of the term. Most, if not all, of these disparate groups have different canons, different rituals, different Bibles. You surprised?
No.
Good, you shouldn't be. There are more Christians outside of the accepted Roman Catholic and Protestant brands than within them. External evidence about acceptance, now interpretation. King Jimmy. Not a bad translation. I use it for study. And then you got the nearly inspired version, the NIV. And it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on. Why? We had fun on one of the broadcasts. John, I'm going to prepare mansions for you. Oh, okay. You go down to about verse 26, and it says, and anyone who does this, I will come in and make my abode with them, and my Father will also. Same Greek word. He gets an abode, we get a mansion. Woo-hoo! What kind of translational integrity is there? So I checked out all of the English versions. They all said mansion. And then I went and I looked at the versions that were written after the King James said mansions. Now, Luther said apartments, and other versions said homes. But when we translated into Vietnamese, guess what we said? And I did all the translational work. Mansions, Chinese, mansions. Huh? Because we have taken one error and just replicated it. Total New Testament manuscripts, 5,300 in the Greek. Maybe 5,500 now. In the Latin, 10,000. In others, 9,300. 24,000 copies altogether. Now, this is up to maybe the year 1300, 1400. This is before the printing press, before the Gutenberg printing press. Total manuscripts we have compiled prior to 600 AD, 230. How many Bibles are there?
One.
One? How many translations are there?
Four.
What? Why? Because people cannot agree on what they reckon it says. That was all external evidence. Now we have internal evidence, and this will we'll wind up on this, I think, tonight. Michael's going to hate this. You want to hear this bit? I wouldn't tell him at all.
He's going to have to listen to his tapes.
He is. He's going to have to listen to his own tapes, yeah. He does, actually. Sometimes he'll ring me up and tell me that. There are three reasons. Four reasons, actually, I have. Types and anti-types, fulfill prophecy, hidden bits in between. We'll get them one by one. Types. Types are where in the Old Testament you have a type of Jesus. You have something happening and it's a picture of Jesus. This is what the whole Old Testament's about. Jesus said, it all talks about me. So if you're ever lost in the scriptures, if you're ever lost, you open up at Amos and you don't know what it means, you say, good grief, what was this turkey talking about? Look for Jesus on the page. May work. It works a lot better for me than it doesn't work. Adam is a type of the prototype. He was a type. Jesus was the type also of the new creation, the prototype of each creation. Noah talked about a new creation. Moses is a type of the deliverer, bringing the children out of Egypt. David, he was a picture of Jesus, the warrior. Solomon, a picture of Jesus, the builder. Then you have the antitypes. You have Cain, Abel, Isaac, Ishmael. Northern kingdom, southern kingdom. You've got these types, then you've got the antitypes, and now you have shadows, what's called a shadow in theological terms, shadows and substance. The tabernacle was a shadow of Jesus. Everything in the tabernacle, in fact, everything in the Holy of Holies was a picture of Jesus. Everything in the temple of Solomon was a picture of Jesus. The rock Moses beat on and out came water of life, that was Jesus. All these were a picture, a shadow of Jesus. You go to the tabernacle, and I'll just go real fast here because I don't want to bore anyone witless. You end up having an Ark of the Covenant. It's covered, it's timber. On the outside, it's beautiful timber, hardwood timber, so it's lasting, everlasting. Then it's covered in gold, speaks of his purity. Then over that is badger skins, which says that it's not going to look very pretty. Isaiah says in Isaiah, very early in the chapter, he says, who would want to look at him? He's so ordinary. Isaiah 53. Inside it is the Ten Commandments, the two tablets. And then there's the rod, Aaron's rod that budded, talking about life, the commandments that talked about death. The whole thing is a picture of Jesus. We can go through the whole Old Testament and get shadows of the substance that was to follow. Internal evidence number two, fulfilled prophecy. Now, we're not going to prove anything here because that would take longer than we got. But these prophecies in the Old Testament, we know that they dated from at least 250 years before Christ, because that's when the caves of Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's when these things were discovered. They were sealed up 250 years before the birth of Christ. It wouldn't have mattered if it was one day before. If you could give me the winner of tomorrow's race, I'd take that as a great prophecy. Huh? This is 250 years before, at least, the prophecy said the Messiah will be born in Jerusalem. The Messiah will be born of a virgin. The Messiah will be rejected by his own people. The Messiah will be betrayed by one of his own followers. The Messiah will be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. The Messiah is going to die of crucifixion with pierced hands and feet. The Messiah will be buried in a rich man's grave. The Messiah will be raised from the dead. All of these things were written 250 years before Jesus died. Now, I've heard all the arguments. Believe me, I've heard some frogs droppings. But they don't hold water. The last one, where is that man, Vic? Where is that man? No, that man, Michael, he must really be in a bad way. He's left me to take up the offering. You poor people. Every Hebrew name, proper name, had a meaning. Jesus. Saviour, you will call his name Jesus because he shall save his people from their sins. Emmanuel, God with us. It didn't matter who it was. They all had a name and they all meant something in Hebrew. Now this is worth coming for tonight. And if you think this is good, you ain't heard nothing yet because I've got tomorrow morning to go. Bigger offerings. The word Adam in Hebrew means man. He had a son called Seth. Seth, the word in Hebrew means to be appointed or appointed. Enosh, his son, means mortal or will die. Kenan, his son, means sorrow. Mahalalel, his son, means the blessed God. Jared, his son, means shall come down. Will drop. Enoch means teaching. Enoch was the one who was a friend of God. One day he just didn't come home for soup. Methuselah means his death will bring, or his death will tell. Lamech means despairing. And Noah means comfort and rest. Have we all got that? Okay. Okay, now let's talk about something entirely different. Put the meanings of those first generations between Adam and Noah into one sentence, and here's what it reads. Man is appointed mortal sorrow, but the blessed God shall come down teaching that his death shall bring the despairing ones comfort and rest. Let me read you that again. Man is appointed to mortal sorrow, but the blessed God shall come down teaching that his death shall bring the despairing comfort and rest. Was that worth coming for? I can read you all the way through from there to Jesus. I haven't kept all the names, but I can. This is freely available on the internet, by the way. You can just go straight on the web and find it. On YouTube, go into the, how did I get it last time? I'll let you know. Just email me. I'll let you know. I'll put it out on the PowerCast. That's what I'll do. We have a PowerCast every week. It's a podcast. And the coughing one and I just call each other names and laugh a lot. And some people say it's they learn a lot from it, don't they? They must be really ignorant, eh? They learn from us. Anyway, the fame of the stronghold of Babylon and sorrow extend their borders like a plant beyond the place of division. Division, the Tower of Babel. But I will make Babylon fade away. I can go through this whole thing, but I'll just end with the one just before Jesus. I have asked God about the ransomed of the Lord, those exiled in Babylon. My father is awesome. God will raise up a helper. A helper? A helper? God will raise up a helper. The just one will the Lord raise up. God is the one who helps. May the gift of Jacob increase in greatness, for God is with us. God is with us. What name is that? Emmanuel. We can take you from Adam to Emmanuel, Jesus the Christ. And every name of every male son going down that line tells the story of the gospel. Wow.
I wonder why that list was so
important. Yeah, really. There was a lot of begetting done there, I'll tell you that. Well, no wonder Israel was called the picture people. The oracular people of God who would show out his glory. Compare this against the New Testament record, where there was dissension from the outlet. Followers calling themselves after various teachers. I'm of Apollo. I'm of Paul. I'm of Christ. Leaders standing up against each other in public. Paul calling out Peter in Galatians. Whole groups sparring with each other for supremacy. This started in the New Testament. It didn't start 100 years later, guys. In Corinthians, Paul says, "For it's been declared to me that some of you, by them which are of the house of Chloe, that they are, there are contentions amongst you. Now this I say, that every one of you who says, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul?" There is evidence in the Bible of this happening. We're not making this stuff up. Dissension from the outset. Old Testament, singularity. New Testament, dissension. Where teachers and leaders started dividing and opposing each other. Paul even called Hymenaeus hyena. And Philetus, he called them a cancer. That's pretty heavy words. The Ebionites under James, which was a religion that started under James. Paul withstands Peter to the face in Galatians. Now, here's a picture I want you to get. We all talk, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have the New Testament church? Do you remember when you were back in church? Wouldn't it be lovely to have a New Testament church? All of us lovey-dovey and all together and doing this thing. They had it. But when Peter, who loved the taste of salami, when Peter, who didn't mind a bit of barbecued ribs, when Peter gets to Antioch, Paul has to, and he gets in there dancing and doing the old 1-2 with the you know, folk dancing Greeks or whatever they were doing. He loved it. He thought it was a, and he should have loved it too because he was the apostle. It should have gone to the Gentiles. He was the apostle that Jesus let down the sheet to and said, don't call unclean what I've called clean. He was that apostle. He was the one that was supposed to go to the Gentiles. Why did God have to raise up Paul? And train him God had to raise up Paul and train him by himself in the desert. He couldn't afford to send him off to the church. And that was what Paul taught others. He said, get good teachers to teach good people. That was his thing. But God didn't do it with him. Why? Because they'd already started messing up back then. They were having blood sacrifices, Acts chapter 17, up to a quarter of a century after Jesus. They still needed blood of a goat, a lamb's actually. You read about it where Paul goes back and they say, listen, there's a few Nazarites here fulfilling their vows. Would you buy them? Go ahead and even buy the sacrifices for them. Oh yeah, 25 years after the death of Jesus. I'm getting lost now. I should shut up. So here they are in Galatians in chapter 1, chapter 2. He says, whoever they are, I don't care. They look like pillars. I don't give a rip. He says, because when Peter was there, I withstood him to the face. Because when people came down from James and John, when people came down to see us, he scarpered off from eating salami with the Gentiles and went over here to the Jews' table and said, hello, hi, here I am. Yes, I've been taking care of this bunch, that one and that one and that one. They all eat salami. And that one over there dances really badly. Why was this big, by the way? It was big because every time they got together, they had a meal. And at the end of the meal, the agape feast, they used to call it, they would have the remembrance of Christ. They'd remember Jesus. They'd just pick up a piece of bread and wine and say, here's to you, Jesus. That was it, communion. For the first time in history, we had two Lord's tables. For the first time in history, we had a Lord's table there for the Jews and one over here for the Gentiles. For the first time in history, we had schism coming into the body of Christ. For the first time in history, we had people saying, I am of that group and I am of the Reformed group. That's why it's important for us to remember this stuff. It's important for us to remember this stuff didn't start with the Reformation. This started in the Bible. This dissension. How does that compare with the Old Testament? Singularity on one side, total. I mean, it's just anyone, whoever wins the fight, which is exactly what happened. The Ebionites, and then you had later the Nazarenes, you had the Nicolaitans. In Revelation it talks about them and says they're bad people indeed. And the Gnostics and the Marcionites came a bit later. You really, Mike taught on this in the PowerCast back last September called The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And it was gold. You've got to listen to it, family. There's only one conclusion I can draw from all of these facts. And I've told you facts tonight. None of what I've told you is guesswork. And that is while the scriptures, some people call it the law, the psalm and the prophets, it's vindicated and proven out thoroughly. The New Testament is quite another matter. This was covered in even more detail. We did another PowerCast called The Doctrine of Scripture, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, Part 4. So, tomorrow morning, I am going to be showing why, when you say that Jesus was a good and wise teacher, why it's nothing but crap. It is intellectual crap. And then, in the next session, I'm going to be giving the four reasons why the disciples were telling the truth, the eight different hypotheses of what could have happened, all of the ones that have ever been thought of since the year dot, the facts, the six or seven facts that we have to accept in the New Testament testimony of Jesus, and then I'm going to tell you why I believe that there can only be one answer. Can only be one answer. Now, most of the people, if Jesus Christ, Paul said, if Jesus came out of the grave, Great. And if he didn't, we're idiots. And yet most idiots I know have never spent 5 hours in their whole life examining the facts behind the possibility of what could be the greatest thing that has ever happened in this poor old world. And this is why in the gospel, what we are teaching is we are teaching these fundamentals now. We'll be teaching them all weekend. I hope you can join us. Please tell me you're going to be here. I know some people have jobs and all of that, but gosh, it is so lovely and encouraging to see your faces here tonight. I hope I haven't bored you too much with a herd of horses and all of that. But thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your interest. And as long as we have breath in the gospel revolution, people like Vic up there, people like Mike and Jeff, people like myself, as long as we have breath, we are going to be preaching this gospel. The gospel, see, there's no sense in me saying that God in you and God in me, we're one. Unless I can rest with absolute assurance on the fact that that man did come out of the grave and he did make a new creation and he did take us into his body. He did hide us in the cleft of the rock as the fire of God went over him, as the anger of God went over him, as all of that stuff in Revelation hit down on Jesus the Christ. We were hidden in the rock. And we, new creation, live to tell this story. Listen, Mr. Person with an AK-47 who wants to, or a knife that wants to cut people's heads off. Listen, you are perfect, holy, and righteous in the eyes of God. I want to leave you with a challenge tonight. What would change in your life if you totally believed that you were perfect in every sense? What would change?
I say that he was a prophet. He was just a prophet.
I'm going to repeat this for the microphone. That last question was, people say that Jesus was just a prophet. Is there anything wrong with that? Is that right? Good. Yeah, Islam says that. But if Jesus was just a prophet, all of these other prophets in the past, they said, the Lord says, the Lord would say unto you. Jesus didn't. He said, I say unto you. Big difference. He actually thought he was perfect. What a gumdrop.